Ball Hawks.
The ball is caught.
Game over, baby.
Touchdown. The game is over. They are going nuts at Century League.
Hey und herzlich willkommen zum offiziellen Podcast der German Seahawkers. Heute mit Jonas.
Ein saftiges Servus, Grüezi und Hallo zu einer weiteren Folge Ballhawks, dem offiziellen Podcast der German Seahawkers. Wir befinden uns metertief in der Offseason, melden uns aber heute vor dem Draft oder vor unseren Draft-Vorschau-Folgen noch einmal bei euch, weil wir eine kleine Sonderfolge haben. Wir haben nämlich gleich einen Gast im Gepäck, den wollen wir euch vorstellen. Kommt aus Kanada, sprich es wird wieder Englisch werden. Aber bevor wir dahin übergehen, will ich erstmal meinen lieben Kollegen Thomas begrüßen. Moin, moin.
Moin, moin, servus, Gute und hallo und endlich wieder Football-Content. Wir sind quasi als das U-Boot in der Offseason aufgetaucht und dieser Frühlingsausblick, Drafts, der rückt näher. Endlich wieder relevante News rund um Football, bevor es dann wieder in das Sommerloch geht.
Auf jeden Fall. Und bevor wir jetzt in den Hauptteil dieser Folge gehen, gibt es tatsächlich noch einmal Seahawks-News, die gestern reingeflattert sind. Da sprechen wir jetzt noch mal kurz drüber und dann starten wir in den Hauptteil.
Frisch aus dem Lockerroom, unsere Seahawks-News.
Ja, und da ist ein bekannter Name wieder zurück in Seattle. Die Seattle Seahawks haben gestern am Freitag, wir nehmen am Samstag auf, Drew Lock wieder unter Vertrag genommen als Backup-QB. Die Vertragsdetails sind jetzt noch nicht ganz raus. Es ist davon auszugehen, dass da jetzt nicht viel Geld investiert wurde. Aber Drew Lock ist wieder da. Werden wir auch gleich nochmal mit unserem Gast drüber sprechen. Aber jetzt nochmal ein ganz kurzer Eindruck von dir, Thomas. Was sagst du dazu? Ist das ein bisschen Wink mit dem Zaunfall auch Richtung Sam Howell vielleicht?
Das ist kein Wink, das ist ein Wedeln mit dem Zaunfall. Also meine ersten beiden Gedanken waren, Nummer eins ist Exit Howell, also es kann nicht weitergehen mit ihm. Du hast ja in der Vorbesprechung schon gesagt, die Eindrücke aus dem Trainingscamp, die waren ja furchtbar. Und das Packers-Spiel, was wir gesehen haben, war auch nicht Werbung für ihn. Natürlich hat er vielleicht sich mehr erhofft, als Gino weggegangen ist, aber mit der Verpflichtung dürfte ihm jetzt klar gemacht worden sein, hey, Nummer eins war nichts, Nummer zwei wird vielleicht auch schwierig. Du willst ihn natürlich nicht für nichts gehen lassen. Exit oder Cut wäre natürlich möglich, aber Trade, naja, du hast genug bezahlt für ihn, ein bisschen was zurückkommen wäre auch gut. Und mein zweiter Gedanke war, Drew Lock war ja im Prinzip immer so die klassische Nummer zwei, der auch nie irgendwie gemotzt, gemeckert hat etc., als damals die Entscheidung pro Gino fiel. Von daher ist das, glaube ich, auch fürs Mannschaftsgefüge ganz gut, wenn du zementiert hast, hey, das ist unsere Erwartungshaltung Nummer eins, das ist unser Nummer zwei und jeder weiß, woran er ist. Das dürfte jetzt relativ klar sein.
Auf jeden Fall. Ist auch noch. Ja, denke ich auch. Also wir werden gleich nochmal drüber sprechen, aber ich glaube, die Situation ist jetzt auch ganz klar. Sam Darnold ist die Nummer eins, Drew Lock ist die Nummer zwei, auch weil John Schneider ihn sehr mag. Ja, was dann dahinter passiert, werden wir sehen. Aber wir switchen jetzt kurz in die englische Sprache gleich nach dem Trainer und begrüßen unseren Gast und dann werden wir das ganze Thema, wie es im Moment um die Seahawks steht, was von der neuen Offense zu erwarten ist und auch nochmal, was so in den Draft reingeht, werden wir nochmal besprechen und wechseln wir jetzt einfach mal.
Touchdown Seahawks!
Competition Wednesday, das Thema der Woche.
Yeah, now we switched from German to English because we have a guest on our hand. And without further ado, I'd like you to introduce you to Bryce Kootz. Bryce, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me on. Really looking forward to talking Hawks with you.
Yeah, you're as I said in the German intro, you're sitting in Canada. For the people who don't know you, what do you do? How is your connection with the Hawks? And where can people find you?
Okay, fair enough. My connection to the Hawks, I've been a lifelong fan. I grew up in Vancouver, BC, so I'm literally like a two-hour drive from Seattle. So a lot of times being down there at Seahawk games, I lived in the area for a while And yeah, coach football. So that's one thing for me. Played college ball down there as well in the state of Washington. So yeah, for me, that's how I kind of got my fandom going. And then on the other side, started a podcast last year with a friend of mine, Ryan McMillan, and we run the Hawk Zone Rundown podcast. So you can find us on YouTube and Spotify and all those places. But yeah, that's kind of my Hawk affiliation, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, so like you said, you're an expert. We're just here in Germany watching our Seahawks, but you're pretty close there, and you know ball. So yeah, really happy to have you. Like you said, the Hawks on Rundown. For everybody who doesn't know it, we will be linking the Spotify and the YouTube link in the show notes, so people can find you there. And yeah, really, really happy that you're here today, because yeah, even though it's the off season, it hasn't been quiet around the Seahawks, right?
No, it hasn't. This is my favorite time of year, honestly, is the off season. Like, I find it in some respects more exciting than the regular season, to be honest.
Yeah, even though there's no game action, there's a lot going on. And speaking about a lot going on, Thomas wasn't really involved, so I'd like to call him back in. So yeah, we're going to talk about the state of the Seahawks a bit. And yeah, I think Thomas, there's like we said, a lot going on, especially after the first season of Mike McDonough being at the helm here.
Yeah, it was a rough start for the start of the second season without Gino, without DK, and a lot of things are going on. And yeah, we have a new formation in the offense. We have a new offensive coordinator, and I think we have a pretty new style in maybe running the offense. But looking to all of those additions from the offseason, let's check the overall vibe in the Pacific Northwest. You said you're very close because you're located in Vancouver. Can you describe the vibe at Puget Sound for the Seahawks right now?
I would say right now, it's interesting because you're going from what they had with Pete Carroll, right? And there was a kind of standard that had been set for 15 years with Pete and John. Everyone knew what to expect. There were certain mantras, always compete and all those kind of things. And last year was really, it felt kind of disjointed. And that was the interesting thing for me when you talk about the Geno and DK trades that transpired this offseason. It felt like you didn't have a clean slate in a way, from where most head coaches, when they come into a new situation, they get a clean slate. Like, it's wiped clear, let me do my thing. And that was one thing Pete, even when he came in, mentioned in his press conference. Like, they wiped the slate clear for me to do things my way. I think they did to an extent with Mike McDonald, except they didn't have the same amount of overturn of the roster as Pete did when he came in. So Mike really inherited Pete's team. And I think it was along the lines of, hey, look, we still want to try and win with this roster. We don't want to tear it all down and rebuild it. So do what you can with this. We got a 10-7 season, but as you saw throughout the season, you could see the limitations of the roster as it was currently constructed by Pete, because really they didn't add much until they added, you know, Tyrese Knight into the defensive, you know, lineup, along with trading for Ernest Jones and shipped out the inside linebackers. That defensive unit wasn't playing up to the standard we were kind of expecting it to, with Mike McDonald coming in as this new defensive whiz kid. And then on the offensive side, that was just a disconjointed mess all year. We've all kind of heard, you know, from DK talking about it to, you know, reports and stuff of just, like, they were going to fire Ryan Grubb after the bye week, potentially. It was that bad, and things were just that disjointed. And so what I would say now the vibe is I think with Clint Kubiak coming in and this new staff, now Mike McDonald fully gets an offseason as a head coach. He's not late to the party, to the hirings, and he's been able to kind of see what it's like to be a head coach, where his shortfalls were in this season. I think what you would say is there's more maybe hope that this team starts to ascend again, rather than a level of, okay, we're still trying to figure out if we're standing on solid ground. Are we about to fall over, or are we about to actually go in the right direction? So I think you got more on the positivity side with Mike McDonald. With John Schneider and the moves that have made with Gino and DK, definitely sent some waves with everybody here. And I think you've got a situation where Geno Smith was a very polarizing player in Seattle. You had, and it was interesting because I was talking with Dan Vians of Seahawks Forever, and we were talking about a bell curve. You know how you have a grading scale that's a bell curve. You can either do, you have one extreme and the other extreme, and then somehow there's somewhere in the middle. You either had people that absolutely thought Geno was a superstar. You had people that absolutely couldn't stand Geno. And then there was a good portion of Seahawks fandom that were kind of in the middle. And they were kind of in this like, yeah, he's a good quarterback. I don't know if he's an elite quarterback or if he's a horrible quarterback, but he's a good quarterback. And I think with, you know, you see what his contract is now that Vegas has paid him, the Albert Breer report that kind of came out that painted that he felt he was disrespected by Seattle. And I think a lot of people have blown that out of proportion. It, to me, felt like what you had was, if you look at the guys that are no longer on this roster, Tyler, DK, and Geno, were all guys that were very big Pete Carroll guys. They very much bought into Pete's mentality, Pete's way of doing things. And I think it was just, you know, DK mentioned it on the Marshawn Lynch and Mike Robb show that he felt like an outsider. And I think that's where that disjointness kind of happened with the Seahawks last year. And I think now you've got brought in guys in Cooper Kupp and Sam Darnold that love ball. And I think that's a big thing that was missing from this team. And there's still some guys on this team, I think, that qualify as maybe more Pete guys than they are Mike guys and this new era. And I think that's the one thing. They want guys here that love football and aren't so absorbed with the extracurricular stuff that goes on of being a celebrity sports star. They want guys that are going to grind all the time, that are going to be in the building, that just want to win, want to get better. And not that DK, Geno, and them didn't want to. I think it was just they had a different alignment on how to do it than Mike McDonald did.
I snapped 2 points of view from your word. You said now it's more like Mike guys. So maybe it's now more Mike McDonald's team and not Pete Carroll's team on the one hand. And on the other hand, you said it's not a rebuild. Would you call it a rebuild light? Because maybe Sam Darnold is a little downgrade to Geno. Cooper Kupp isn't that young anymore. What's your opinion about that?
I would call it a reset. I've been saying on our show that the offense is in a reset stage. The defense has absolutely been constructed in Mike McDonald's image now. You can see it, the way that it played during the back half of that season. On offense, I would say they reset. They kind of did the same thing they did on defense last year where, okay, we're going to try and make this work. They literally didn't change much on the offense. They brought in the same guys. They brought in a new offensive coordinator, Ryan Grubb, and Scott Huff from the UW last year, and we're like, okay, cool, make this work because this is what we want to do. It didn't work. And I think what they've then realized is we need to reset this in Mike's image so that the offense and the defense play together. And that's what you didn't have last year. Like, you look at the numbers for the Seahawks when it comes to how much they were running the ball versus passing it. There was a massive disproportion in percentage. You had the Seahawks upward at 65 to 70% pass, and they were down 30 to 40% run. That's not a winning formula when the defense you're having on your team is designed to not necessarily take the ball away and be a super opportunistic, but play sound defense that bend that doesn't break. You then need an offense on the other side that can make long drives and turn out the ball and chew out yardage and make it so that then when that other team's offense comes on the field, they're in the pressure cooker of, oh, we've got to go down the field and score. Like, we got to take shots. And that's where Mike McDonald's defense gets those opportunities because of the scheme he runs in the back end and the misuse of and misalignment of guys and how he moves them all around. That's where they get to be opportunistic. They don't have that and they're playing these shootout games, which we saw a lot of Seattle this year play, Mike McDonald's defense doesn't really get to be as impactful as it can when he had it in Baltimore and the University of Michigan. And that's where I think you see this reset is, okay, now we're going to align this offense with what Mike wants it to be, which is run the ball, play action, be smart with the football, don't turn it over, because that was one thing that killed the Hawks last year were the turnovers from this offense.
This reset also affects the offensive line. We talked about before about what to do with the draft, but let's talk later on with the draft pick number 18. But in your opinion, how can we fix the issues in the O-line with our new offensive coordinator. Do you have one master idea to fix it?
I don't know if it'll be one master idea, but what I'll say that they've done that's really interesting is if you look at the, they kept the passing coaching staff intact. The receiver coach stayed, Jake Pete stayed as passing game coordinator. And then what they did is they changed, and they're, sorry, the running back coach too, and Polamalu stayed, who's really, really good. But then when you look at the other side, when it came to running the ball, they revamped everything. And they brought in a bunch of guys that understand Clint Kubiak's system and have been in that system for years. Not like, oh, I dabbled in it a little bit for like a season. No, I've been in it for like four or five, like Rick Dennison, or as John Schneider calls him, Rico, John Benton. You know, they've brought in guys that really know how to make this system work. And you saw that in New Orleans last year with Dennison and Benton. Like, their offensive line got decimated. Like, they were, they had the, in my opinion, they got completely destroyed, but they were still able to run the ball. And we had a relatively healthy offensive line, even when Abe Lucas came back, and we still struggled to run the ball. So what I think with this offensive line, and I think people are going to hate me saying this, you need to be patient with it, because it can't be fixed overnight. And this has been a problem for over a decade. We've seen it for a long time that Seattle has struggled with offensive line. Seattle's biggest issue has been the development in-house of their offensive line. They haven't been able to develop players in-house. They've got guys, you know, Mark Lewinsky, I think of, Damian Lewis, other guys, and then they go off to other teams and they look like serviceable, above average NFL guards or offensive linemen. Mm-hmm. And you're going, well, why couldn't they do that in Seattle? Seattle has also had an identity issue on their offensive line. If you go back and look from when Jeremy Bates was here, when Pete Carroll first showed up, you had them bring in Alex Gibbs, who runs the exact same scheme that they're about to run now, which is the wide zone. He retired before they could get into camp. And so they weren't able to actually get a proper run game that first year. Then they go and hire Tom Cable. Tom Cable comes in, and his is a wide zone scheme as well, or an outside zone running scheme. But the big thing that Tom Cable took advantage of was you could cut the backside of the line, of the D line. When they would pursue across, you could cut it. Then the NFL put a rule in 2015 that you couldn't do that anymore. And what did we watch? The offensive line for Seattle in the run game started to have some issues. You started to see it not be as effective. Marshawn wasn't the same. He got injured and so on and so forth. And then you brought in Mike Solari. And Mike Solari didn't run zone. He ran power gap. That was his thing. So you saw Mike Upati come in, and you saw DJ Fluker come in, these big, powerful guys that just go straight. They don't really like to go on angles, and they'll pull in. They'll do different things. After Mike Solari, you then ran into Andy Dickerson. And they brought in they tried to bring in the Ram system with Shane Waldron, which was an utter disaster, and we can all have scurvy on that one. But you brought that in, but your personnel didn't match the scheme. You still had Fluker. You still had Mike Upati, and they tried to bring in some other guys, but it just didn't work. You know, now you've gone from that to Scott Huff's scheme with Ryan Grubb, which wasn't really an identity at all, because at least with the other guys, they committed to what they were doing. It was like, we're a power gap team or we're a zone team. Last year, they tried to do both, and it failed epically. You couldn't figure out what Seattle's run game was. Like, I remember me and Griffin Sturgeon were talking, and it was like Griff figured out that, hey, if they fake to the left, they were play action passing every time because they never ran to the left. And it was like, that shouldn't be a key tell for the average fan or the average person to watch an NFL game and go, hey, yeah, every time Seattle does this, they're throwing the ball. They're like, NFL teams are going to catch into that. And so that's where I look at now, when you have this unity of identity with the offensive staff, I think it's going to bode well for everybody, because they're all going to understand the same terminology. They're all going to understand language. And when you look at some of the draft picks Seattle had, like Christian Haynes, he got to work on his body. He struggles a little bit in the way he's built for the NFL, but he is a zone guard. That is what he is known for. He was never designed to run power gap, which is why I think you saw LaMea beat him out through practices to play. And that's where I think with this, to answer your question, Thomas, I think you're going to see Seattle make strides in the right areas of the offensive line, which we haven't seen at all. And it's going to seem massive to fans. It's going to be like, holy crap, we ran for 150 yards today, and Ken Walker and Charbonnet are going all over the place, and we actually could protect the quarterback, and Sam Darnold only took one sack. And we're going to think it's amazing. And we're just going to see it get better and better and better rather than going through, holy crap, we've been through six games right now and we can't run the ball for more than 40 yards. Yeah. Like that, I think, will kind of be the you know, obsolete part of it. And the new norm will be, hey, they actually function. They're not going to go from being 31st to top five, but I could see them going from 31st to like late teens, early 20s as an offensive line unit. And we're going to look at that and go, wow, that's a massive improvement to have a, you know, competitive, comparable offensive line.
Mm-hmm. So your take is just, hey, let's be patient with this new formatted offense.
Yeah.
But talking about Geno is gone, DK is gone. For me, it felt like a kind of a fire sale because it went so quickly. Yep. You said Geno felt kind of disrespective. Now we're facing Sam Darnold in this offense. We're facing Washington native Cooper Kupp. Would you like to say it's a downgrade, or would you like to say it's more having the pressure and the responsibility for this offense pending on more shoulders, not just those two? Because I felt as a receiver, JSN is already number one. So when we really miss DK?
I don't, in this scheme, no, you're not going to miss DK the way that I think some people fear that you may miss DK. When, like, for me, I've gone back and I've studied this, and you look at way back when Gary Kubiak, Clint's dad, mm-hmm. and Mike Shanahan ran this offense in the 90s with Denver. They had two receivers. They had Ed McCaffrey and Rod Smith. They were almost carbon copies of each other. They could run the same routes. They could do the same things. They could block. And they didn't really have a third receiver. Their third receiver was their tight end in Shannon Sharp. And when you look at how this offense has slowly evolved throughout the years, even if you go back where Mike Shanahan learned it from, which was Mike Holmgren in San Francisco, who learned it from Bill Walsh, the receivers have all been very similar in their skill sets. You don't really have this true, massive, you know, huge guy that can go and just run vertically. And if you look at DK, that's what he is. He is a vertical threat. He's not a well-rounded receiver. And I love DK. And I love what he brought, but you're not asking DK to run choice routes. You're not asking DK to run option routes. You're asking DK, hey, you're running a hook, you're running a slant, you're running a post, you're running a go. Like, those are your things. And for a big bodied receiver, one thing they should be good at is winning the contested catch. And that's something DK struggled with enormously to do. And I think part of it was he wasn't a great hands catcher a lot of the time. He used his body a lot of the time to make some of those catches just because he was bigger and he could physically get to that point. And so I agree. JSN is the number one. I thought JSN became the number one halfway through last season. And it was very evident. He doesn't have the same vertical speed that DK has, but I don't know if you need that. If you're running by yourself for 5 yards, you've got enough. And you saw him catch screens and make guys miss and get all the way down the field. And so I think what you've seen with this offense, moving off of Geno to Sam Darnold, I'll start there. You've reset your quarterback room 7 years younger with a player of comparable skill set. So in that being said, like, people are, oh, Sam's only had one good year. Well, that was the same thing we said about Geno in 2022 when he only had one good year and we paid him relatively similar money and we're hoping for him to duplicate it again. The thing that I think gives Sam Darnold the best chance of success, he knows this offense inside and out. Even though it's Clint Kubiak and not Kevin O'Connell, Clint Kubiak learned this offense from the exact sources of it in Kyle Shanahan, Mike Shanahan, and his father, Gary, where if you look at Kevin O'Connell, he has learned it more through the grapevine through being on McVay's staff, who learned this system from Kyle. So that's where you can see that the kind of the roots of this system kind of spreading out and stuff throughout the NFL. And so for Clint, he has all the resources. And this is one thing that I think is huge that I don't think a lot of people understand is Clint Kubiak can go and make a call and be like, hey, Dad, I'm running into this issue. What have you and Mike done in the past to handle this when teams give you this look when we go to this and try and run this concept? And he's actually got those resources to pull from where Ryan Grubb last year didn't have anything. And that's a huge thing in the NFL is having those resources outside of your own building that you can go and pull from to get ideas on how to combat certain things. So from Sam to Geno, I don't see a massive drop off. There's a bit of one for sure. Geno was playing good football, but I think I'll put it this way. The floor with Sam's definitely deeper than Geno, but I think the ceiling's also higher. You're getting a guy that's 28 that still, I don't think, has reached his full capability yet. Now with DK to JSN, I think you're actually, and this is may people may find this insane. I think you're getting an upgrade going from DK to a JSN and Cooper Kupp situation than DK and JSN. The reason I say that is Cooper Kupp is such a savvy route runner, but Cooper Kupp is going to be such a good mentor for JSN in teaching him, because their skill sets are so similar, how to be elite. Like Cooper Kupp, we have talked about, like you think about Cooper Kupp's career. He has the triple crown as a receiver, catches, yards, touchdowns, and a Super Bowl all in one season. We've never been able to say that about DK Metcalf. We've always argued, is DK top 10? Is DK top 7 receiver in the NFL? Is he top 5? There was a point in time when everyone was like, Cooper Kupp is the top receiver in the NFL. And if you even look at last year, and I know people bring up injuries and, oh, he's, you know, over 30 and he's got all these. He played 12 games last year. He was still posting 150 yards, 120 yards a game. And if Seattle went and signed him to the money that they did, Seattle is very diligent when it comes to injuries. They aren't going to throw money at someone that they think has a chance. They're going to have issues with injuries and so on. So they went and did the medicals and the physicals and everything on Cooper Kupp. I think they have a pretty good sense that he maybe was having durability issues because of certain things he was doing for the Rams, like in the way their system was run, that he maybe not have to deal with in Seattle. I think you're looking at more of a just a swap than you're looking at a massive drop-off or increase. I think really what you've done is you've allowed a more alignment in your offense to meet your offensive coordinator and this offensive staff's needs.
Mm-hmm. Facing all those changes, in my mind, it's very consequent from GM John Schneider to do all those moves. But it felt also kind of brave to say, hey, we try this one, we try that one. But in your mind, when going back to some years ago when he put together all those Legion of Boom guys, do you think in 2025, with all those moves he'd made in the past, is he still safe as a GM? Or would you say, oh, the pressure's on in the next draft because he sold them for not that much. People may expect it to get in return. And you also talked about this class of 2025 isn't that loaded with talent. So in your mind, is he still safe or is he kind of under pressure?
I think he's still safe unless they go like 5-12 or 4-13 and have a completely disastrous season. You've reset some things, but the thing I'll say for John Schneider in this regard, and this is where I think, you know, a lot of people want to throw him under the hot seat. I've been one of them with some of the acquisitions he's made, the Jamal Adams trade and different things. John has a lot of leeway. He's gone out and got a new head coach. He's now resetting a room. But to your shirt that you're wearing, Thomas, and this is what I've said a lot on my show, it's very much what Jerry DePoto ran into with the Mariners when he came in. I think what they looked at last year when they moved on from Pete is Jody Allen and Burt Cole and that whole Falcon group sat down and said, okay, John, we're moving off of Pete because we believe in you, but we need you to at least this first year with this new head coach, try and win with this team. Bring in the new head coach, change that, and see if this team all of a sudden gets a spark and wins. They won 10 games. They didn't make the playoffs. So now what I think John's been able to go back and say is, look, I tried to do it with what Pete, who had a big voice in that building and a big say in that building, been able to go back to the ownership and go, look, I tried it with Pete's guys. We brought in Mike. We still had good results, but not great. Now can I do this the way I want to and try and reshape this roster and reset this roster in a way that aligns more with me and Mike's direction than it does with what me and Pete were doing? And that's where I think you see the DK move, the Geno move, cutting and moving on from Tyler Lockett. So again, unless it completely and the bottom falls right out of this team and they go from being 10 wins to 4 wins or 5 wins, I think John Schneider's safe for one more season. But what I will say with that is if they don't make the playoffs this year, he will be in on a very uncomfortable seat in the 2026 offseason because it'll be a, you've reset, you've got all this cap room, you need to do something to get us. And I don't even think, and this is my hot take, I don't even think them getting into the wild card or just getting into the playoffs in 2026, if they bottom out this year, will be able to save them. It'll be, you need to get to the divisional round and be competitive in that game to at least have an opportunity to get that extension to go through past 2027, because his extension ends after the draft in 2027. So I believe that's what will be the case for John, is that this thing goes south this year. You have 2026 to fix this. And oh yeah, by the way, you can't just say, oh, we made it into the playoffs. It needs to be like a division title and we're getting to the divisional round of the playoffs for you to get an extension past said date.
Well, it would be very fun to watch, but enough of looking backwards. Now let's look forwards. And Jonas, you prepared something about next season, I would say.
Yeah, we talked. It's a good good way to continue. We talked about the offense as well, and Bryce, you said about John that they have to be successful. A lot of this success, I think, hinges on the offense. So, the Seahawks brought in Sam Darnold, and you said, it's not even a downgrade to Geno, but they are different. A lot of people said about Sam Darnold that he's too pressure sensitive. But one thing that I thought was pretty telling that in Minnesota, I think they had the 30th most pressure in passing situations last year, and the Seahawks had were in last place and 32nd spot. So do you think that's going to be a problem for Sam Darnold, or is he able to work in this system, even with the flaws he maybe has compared to Geno?
I think he can work in this system. And I look at it this way. When you talk about the comparison between Sam and Geno, I think Geno has a bigger arm. He can make deeper throws down the field, but Geno also sometimes hesitates. And that's where he got in trouble last year with his interceptions. He'd hesitate and then try to fit it into a window. Sam is a quicker processor of information and gets the ball out quicker out of his hand. And so when you look at like what he did last year, he threw for 4,300 yards, 35 touchdowns, 12 interceptions. And we look at what Geno did. He was 21 touchdowns, 15 interceptions. Like, Geno did not have a good year. And a lot of those interceptions for Geno were in the red zone. And so when I look at Sam Darnold, he had a very low red zone turnover rate. His turnovers happen more in the middle of the field or in that kind of area. That's going to happen. You're not getting Tom Brady here. You're not getting Patrick Mahomes or one of these guys. But you're getting a guy, I believe, that is now on the right path to getting to where his draft stock was. We're talking about that was a first round pick and top 10 pick to be precise. And the scheme he's running fits his style of play. It's play action, it's boots, it's moving, it's quick reads. And the biggest thing that changes here is in Clint Kubiak's system, in this system as a whole, the quarterback does not make line call changes or protection calls. That is on the center. The quarterback's whole job is to read the back end, read where the linebackers and the safeties all are, and make that read. He doesn't have to worry about, okay, where is the pocket going? How do I slide the protection? That's on your center. And that's a huge weight coming off a quarterback's shoulders. I can tell you from personal experience, not having to worry about calling line calls. Now I get to process a little bit slower and I can see what's going on with a more clear, you know, precise image of what I think the defense is trying to do. So when I look at that, you know, I think for us as a whole, as an organization, as the Seattle Seahawks and Sam Darnold, I look at it as almost a wash. You're not really downgrading. And I think Sam will be good for Seattle because of the fact you're getting a guy that wants to prove last year wasn't a fluke. You're getting a guy that has the ability. He's now back on the West Coast where he's from. He gets to probably relax a little bit going, hey, look, I proved I can play at the NFL level. I proved I'm worth my draft stock when I got drafted, that I had the talent to do it. And now he's going into an organization, I think, not saying that Minnesota wasn't, but one that has said, hey, look, we believe in you. And for me, I think a good comparison for Sam Darnold is Matt Hasselbeck. And when he came to Seattle and he was the quarterback here, that's who I would say, if you're looking to compare a success for Sam Darnold, compare Sam Darnold to Matt Hasselbeck. Look at what Matt went through when he came to Seattle. He was never considered a top five NFL quarterback, but he was definitely considered a top 10, top 12 NFL quarterback. that's the range you want to see if Sam can get to. If Sam can get to be like, hey, he's between 15 and 10 for top quarterback in the NFL, and what you're paying him, and you have these weapons and the team's winning, that's good football. Teams that win the Super Bowl don't always have a number top five NFL quarterback. Like, Jalen Hurts to me is not a top five NFL quarterback. He's maybe a top 15 NFL quarterback. But we're talking about a team last year where everyone was trying to get rid of Jalen Hurts. They were saying he's, you know, not any good. They need to move on. Maybe they draft somebody. Maybe they make a trade. Whatever it was. Now you're getting a situation in the NFL where if you can build your team correctly, you're going to set yourself up for success rather than relying on a quarterback to carry a flawed NFL team. And that's where it even looks at the draft when you talk about, I know we'll get to that. Quarterbacks are so poorly developed now coming out of college, and they don't get the opportunity the way they did prior in the NFL to get reps. You've got less preseason games where rookie quarterbacks got tons of time to play in those games. So less on-field development, and that means not practice. That means on game fields, really, really pushes back these quarterbacks from actually being successful.
Quarterbacks being successful is a good point. A lot of people were saying Sam Darnold was so successful in Minnesota last year, winning 14 games, because of the weapons he had with Justin Jefferson and Aaron Jones and I wanted to say Zay Flowers. Edison, how do you think about the weapon the Seahawks got? You talked a bit about JSN and Cooper Kupp, and a big thing for Seattle, as you said, is to get the running game going. So looking at, we're coming to the draft later on, but looking at the running back room away from the quarterback and the O-line, what can we expect from JSN as he rose to stardom last year? Can he continue that? And people were saying, okay, yeah, we're not sure. Maybe Ken Walker is kind of a trade chip or something like that. But I think he can fit in this zone running scheme pretty well with this skill. So can Sam Darnold rely on a good set of weapons next year?
I would say yes. You have a very good young – so I'll start with running backs. You got a very good young running back room. Ken Walker, this scheme is designed for his skill set. The gap power they ran last year is not a Ken Walker strength. He's not a power back. He's a slasher. He's a guy that likes to get to the edge and then turn up. And when you look back, the zone scheme that Shane Waldron ran, you saw a better version of Ken Walker in that scheme. When they went to what they ran last year, it suited Zach Charbonnet, who doesn't have the same quick twitch and speed ability. When you were able to run him downhill, like in that Arizona game where he ran for whatever it was, the 100-plus yards, and was like, oh, we've got a running game. That's where you see this, where with what Clint Kubiak's going to do, I think this bodes well or bodes better for Ken Walker and Kenny McIntosh than it does for Zach Charbonnet. And I think Charbonnet will find a role and they'll find a way to get it to work. But I wouldn't expect Zach Charbonnet to be the same explosive back he had moments of being last year. I'd expect K9 to take up more of that. Now, with the receiving core, a big part of this with JSN and Cooper Kupp and MVS with, you know, Marquez Valdes-Scantling is you're not going to see a lot of three receiver sets like you did last year with Seattle. They are going to run more 12, 22, or 13 personnel with Clint Kubiak. And the reason for that is the tight ends are such a big part of the passing game in this offense. You look at, you know, George Kittle was a huge component in the 49ers, Tyler Higbee for the Rams, even Colby Parkinson down there now. And then you look at Kevin O'Connell running it in Minnesota, and you've got TJ Hawkinson. The tight end is a vital part of this offense. So we talk about JSN and Cooper Kupp. I think they're going to both do very well. I expect JSN to probably do better in this system because a lot of this system will fit his skill set. They reduce splits. It puts him on more matchups with safeties and linebackers and getting space created by that than it is on him creating his own space. The way the scheme works itself and lines up and does that will create mismatches for him. And I think you're going to see an offensive coordinator in Clint Kubiak that's going to go, hey, look, I've got two guys that teams are both going to be afraid of because they're both so good at finding zones and sitting in zones. that we might get more man to man. And then you're going to see what the Rams have done to us for years and the 49ers. And they're going to, you run the play action, that wide zone, and run somebody back across on that over route that's going to be all by themselves. And there's going to be easy completions to be had all over the field with his offense with Clint Kubiak. So I would expect if JSN and Cooper Kupp, I think JSN's going to have the better statistical season. But I will say, I think Cooper Kupp will surprise people, as he will not be some washed up, can't do it anymore type of receiver. The biggest thing for me that's going to be interesting with Seattle's receiving core is they need to find guys that are willing blockers. That is a big part of being a receiver in this new offense. And that's one thing with JSN, as we saw last year, is not really a strength of his game. It's not really a strength of MVS's game either. It does for Bobo work, and I think Bobo is going to get a lot of usefulness out of Cooper Kupp being in the building. I think that might actually be the guy that benefits the most, might be Jake Bobo from Cooper Kupp being in there. But that's something that'll be interesting to see how Seattle addresses, because of the fact that the rest of the receiving core outside of Kupp and Bobo aren't the best set of blockers, and that's needed in this offense.
Yeah, but I actually wanted to go there because the Tyler and DK being gone, the rest of the receiving room is pretty depleted. But you said, okay, they are going to use the tight ends more. I think AJ Banner was one of the rookies last year who really overperformed. Like people weren't expecting that much from him, but he really showed that he can be a good part of this offense. Also, Noah Fant is still there, who is not the typical like blocking tight end. He's more of a receiving tight end. So I think there's going to be an avenue there, because he's still on the team and he didn't restructure his contract as other players like Leo Williams and Chandler Woso did. With that being said, the focus on the running game, am I correct in the assumption that the Seahawks won't be like a high scoring team next year? Because the thing I get from Mike McDonald and stuff like that they want to commit to the running game and want to run the football. Is it more like, okay, we're going to like eat the clock and make, like you said, force the other team to deliver points, and then have the defense go at it and having more takeaways? Because this was the problem last season. The defense didn't have the takeaways.
Yeah, I would say that it's not that they're going to be a low scoring team. I think with the Seattle average in there, somewhere probably between, I'd say, 20 to 24 points a game is what I figure this offense will average. So you'll have games where they obviously will blow teams out potentially. What you're going to see, though, is I think you're going to see more of a commitment to kind of what we got accustomed to in the early years of Pete Carroll, which was run the ball and then take your big explosive shot play. And you look at the Saints last year when they were fully healthy, they had the number one scoring offense for the first 4 weeks of the NFL season. They were blowing teams out. And that's how they were doing it. Run the ball, screens, do these different little things, and then bang, they hit you with a shot play, and that's how they'd score their points. And because these drives were methodical, and the biggest thing is they'd capitalize with touchdowns and not settle for field goals. And that's something that I think you'll see with this, is you're going to see more touchdowns in general from these long drives than you will be seeing, okay, we got all the way down the field, now we got to kick a field goal because we stalled out at the 40-yard line. The thing for this team is, if you look at like the 2024 Saints, they leaned heavy. 480 of their snaps were either in 12, 22, or 13 personnel. So you're talking about the tight ends. That's going to be a big jump up from what Seattle, because last year Seattle only had 202 snaps in heavy personnel, which is what those are deemed as in numbers. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see, again, another tight end. I don't know if Noah Fant, even though he hasn't restructured, I don't know if Noah Fant's going to be on this roster. I think there's a good chance if like a Mason Taylor or one of these young tight ends is there for Seattle in day two of the draft, that they may take a swing on him, because realistically, outside of Noah Fant and AJ Barner, you have Brady Russell. And we saw Brady Russell not exactly be the most durable player last year for them. And that's where I look at it. And I know they brought in the guy, I can't even remember his name because I don't think he'll really make the roster, the guy out of San Francisco. But I think you're going to see Seattle move to that kind of thing where they want their other tight end to be a move tight end. And AJ Barner to me is going to be tight end one next year. Like he proved throughout this back half of the season, he really became a viable receiving option, which I think is funny because when he got drafted, he was known for being a blocker coming out of college. He wasn't known for being this great receiving threat because his running mate, who is in this year's draft in Colson Loveland, was the receiving threat for Michigan. So that's where I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they deploy their tight ends. And I even think there's a good chance Seattle's going to have a fullback on this roster, which they haven't had since like basically Mike Robb and Max Strong were the last really good fullbacks Seattle had. And so it'll be interesting to see how the tight ends and all that play into what Clint Kubiak wants to do. And that's where I think you're not going to see the empty shotgun sets that we saw last year for Geno. Huh? You're going to see more guys in there to help deal with blocking. And one big thing you'll see from Clint Kubiak's offense, because they run the ball effectively, is you'll see points where they use more max protection, where they're keeping seven guys in to protect and maybe only running two routes downfield and the running back out into the concept. That's what you'll see more of this year, I think, than we have in recent years.
And it also, going back to the quarterback, relying on the run game and having the center like adjusting the plays as well. Because one thing I saw last year was Geno was always, everybody was talking about it, run the damn play. he was always pretty involved in switching protections and stuff like that. So having to rely on the center now, and also the running game does take pressure away from Sam Darnold.
Completely.
So having said all that, we talked about it in the German part of the pod. The Seahawks made a switch, I won't say, but maybe there's a switch coming at quarterback. What do you think? I asked Thomas about it. What do you think the signing of Drew Lock, who's highly regarded with John Schneider, what does it mean for Sam Howell?
Yeah, exactly. For the other Sam in the QB room, I think this signals that Sam Howell will not be on the 2025 Seahawks roster. If it had been a one-year deal, I would have been like, oh, okay, they're bringing Drew back to compete with Sam. It's a two-year deal. Sam Howell is not going to be on this roster. Whether they trade him or release him, I don't know which one they'll do yet. I think John will probably try and go for a trade, maybe get a fifth or a sixth round pick back in return for what he gave up last year. But I don't think Sam Howell fits with what they want to do now on offense. And I don't think he showed well last year. You know, you think about what he was able to do even in the preseason, and you heard the reports coming out of training camp that he was really struggling. And, you know, especially during that time where Geno was sitting out for a little bit with the injury or whatever it was that Geno had, Sam didn't like seize that opportunity and be like, oh, like we really got to watch it. It was more like when's Geno coming back, everybody? Like, you know,
whoa, okay.
Exactly.
Take it easy. Yeah,
exactly. And that's the whole thing. And so that's where it was like you know, if Sam Howell's going to be our quarterback, like, are we actually going to be able to win and sustain winning games? And for them even to bring Jaren Hall in and then Plumlee as well throughout the season, that's adding more fuel to that. Okay, were they really ever set on Sam Howell after the, you know, preseason? And this to me just really kind of puts that nail in that coffin that I think John looks at and goes, okay, we tried something. It didn't work. We know Drew's a better backup quarterback. We've seen it. He's coming in won football games, because I think that's the biggest comparison here is they looked at that Green Bay game and went, well, if Geno wasn't able to play the following week, would we have really been able to do anything versus Minnesota, or would we be in trouble? And they look at what Drew did when he came in that 49ers game and then played that Eagles game for those two games Geno was out. Yes, they lost the Niners game, but the Niners were a better team. But then in the Eagles game, Drew Lock played good enough to win a football game. And that's what you ask of your backup quarterback. You're not asking him to come in and take over for the starter. You're asking him to keep you afloat for a game or two, so that you don't bottom out and lose two games or three games or whatever it is. If you can go .500 or one game above, that's an ideal situation for that backup quarterback to come into. And so that's what I think they've done here is they've looked at and gone, hey, look, we know Drew fits in this scheme. We know what we get with Drew. Let's go bring him back here. He wants to be here. We want him here. And we'll deal with the Sam Howell situation later on.
The Sam Howell situation is also, like you said, maybe John accepting that he met, we would call it a mistake. It just didn't work out. And he's adjusting, which is a quality. Just not, I really like it. They stick with their guys, but if they don't work out, you have to admit it to yourself and say, okay, it didn't work out. Let's do something else. And the Sam Darnold and the Drew Lock signings do have implications towards the draft. We're talking about it, and even John talked about it. That he always wants to take a quarterback, but he wasn't able to or didn't see the opportunity. So I think Thomas. What's going on there in the draft?
Yeah, the draft room is, as you said, loaded with players. Like Bryce mentioned, we will trade another one or cut another one. But Bryce, you are also a draft expert, also a quarterback expert. Look into the 2025 class. Is it wise to draft a quarterback? Maybe not at position 18, maybe later on, second round, third round, maybe to sit back and back up or maybe develop a quarterback for the future? And if so, what would be your proposal to pick if you would be the GM for one day?
So here, it's interesting to me. I would have said if Geno Smith was still on this roster, picking a quarterback becomes more of a focal point for this team just due to Geno's age. He's 35 years old. Now that you've reset this quarterback room age gap down to 28, in Sam Darnold and Drew Lock, I don't know if quarterback's necessarily as high of a need for Seattle now at this point in the draft as it was 3 months ago at the end of the season, where we're going, okay, we've got to start thinking about life after Geno, and in the sense of we're going to have him for one more year. Do we re-sign him? But let's draft somebody to get in here and learn. And a lot of people have come out and said, and Bob Stelton said it on John's show, that, oh, this is a bad quarterback draft class. I think that's a very, very misguided statement, because yes, it is not like last year's draft class where you had five plus guys go in the first round. Like, you know, that's unheard of. And the only other draft class I can think of that remotely comes close to that was 1983. So if you're telling me between 2024 and 1983, you've had really, and maybe you can throw 2012's class in there with Russell and Luck and RG3, you've had three quarterback classes that are good and then everything else was bad. No, that's not the case. There's still good players in this draft class. Yes, they may not be first round talents, but they can still come in and be capable NFL starters, whether it's a Jackson Dart, a Shador Sanders, Will Howard, Kyle McCord, Quinn Ewers. Those are just some of the names. And so when I look at Seattle and what their position, I would not spend pick 18. No, not a chance. Am I picking a quarterback at 18? But I could see someone in maybe day two, round two, taking someone in day two there, seeing if you can get someone in here that is going to push Drew Lock. You've only signed him for 2 years and it's $5 million for 2 years. So if you get a Will Howard in here that comes in and really impresses you, then you're not losing a lot. And yeah, you keep three quarterbacks for 1 year just because you don't want to push that kid into the game as the backup. But then if he really does impress you, then you move off from Drew. And now he's the backup for year two of Sam. And if Sam doesn't really do it, then this kid's playing. That's the way to do it. And this is where I talked about, you know, earlier with the development of quarterbacks in college. When I look at quarterbacks, especially in the draft process, I look for a couple things. I look at how many games they've started, how many games they've won, and then I look at how do they handle the two-minute drill and third down. Those are huge things at the NFL level that you want to see. And if quarterbacks struggle in those areas and they haven't played a lot, I generally don't look at them as a very good quarterback prospect that you're going to look at and be like, hey, in 2 years, this guy can take NFL snaps. You look at that as more of a, hey, this guy might take his whole rookie contract. And then when you get these guys that have been like a Tyler Shuck, that's 23, 25, turning 26, and we're talking, oh, if he gets gone in the first round, he'll be 30 by the end of his rookie contract. Like, that's not an ideal situation to be in when you take a rookie quarterback. So with Seattle, I could see it being a potential still. I would say I think it's a 50-50 if they do it. I don't think it's as I thought earlier. It'd probably be more like a 60-70 when Geno was still on the roster. Now that they've done what they've done this offseason, I'd say it's more of a 50-50. For me, if they were to take somebody, there's two guys that stick out for me that I think fit this scheme and I think have just the presence of them to be NFL quarterbacks and lead a franchise. One being the one I'd pound the table for is Will Howard, seeing him and what he did at Ohio State. And then I highly recommend to people, go watch John Gruden's QB class, hour-long episode with him. It will completely change your perspective if you have an undecided one on Will Howard, just listening to him talk and him explain himself and all those kind of things. And the other guy is Kyle McCord out of Syracuse. He's another guy that I think fits the system really well. But they're both guys that I think need a year to sit and not be put in the pressure cooker right away and just, hey, we took a guy, we're going to see if it works. Because I know what everyone's already saying, oh, the 2026 class is loaded. You know, I can tell you right now, I doubt Archie Manning is coming out in 2026. He is probably going to be 2027 or 2028. So that takes that out of the equation. So you got Drew Allar, you've got Clade Klubnik. Like, we always talk about next year's class when this year's class is about to get drafted. I don't look at next year and go, yeah, it's drastically, vastly improved over this year. Yeah, there's some prospects that are better for sure, but it's not like the class itself as a whole of the quarterbacks is so much deeper than it was this year. You got guys at the top and guys at the bottom. What I'll say about this year's draft class, this might be the first class in a few years where you're going to see more guys go between round 2 and 5 than you have in, say, the last 5 years, where it's been like, hey, there's been top heavy, and then UDFA in round 6, 7 were taking flyers on guys.
Number 18, fancy enough to keep? Or would you rather say, let's trade down for a suitable player? Or on the other hand, if we keep pick number 18, who would you be picking if you are John Schneider? So we talked about before, if I would be, then I would say, hey, let's all invest in tackle. Let's get Josh Simmons, maybe. Let's get Calvin Brooks. Or maybe a guard is falling down, maybe like Tyler Booker from Alabama. We don't know.
Yeah. Thomas, you give me the good questions here. If it, for me, it all depends really on how the board falls. My stick and pick guys at 18, like if they're there, yeah, and I'm John Schneider and I'm playing GM for the day and I'm sticking and picking. Calvin Banks out of Texas is one because you get the O-tackle guard versatility. Emeka Ebuka, the receiver out of Ohio State, is another guy I would stick and pick for. Donovan Ezeraku, the edge player out of Boston College, is someone that I have like fallen in love with, and he brings something different to that defense and I think could be a blue chip level player for you. And then the other one is Colson Loveland, the tight end out of Michigan. They're guys that if they were there at 18 and somehow got there, I would be very tempted to stay and pick at that spot. Now, I am not against trading down, and if you can recoup more picks in that top 100 area, I'm very on board for doing that because you get more bites at the apple. If you trade down, say, to like between 22 and 26 in this class, Gray Zabel becomes an option, who I know a lot of Seahawks fans love. Donovan Jackson, another guard out of Ohio State, is another guy I'd look at. Shavon Ravel Jr., the corner out of East Carolina, is someone I love and I think would come in and potentially push Reek Woolen for a starting job. Tate Ratledge from Georgia. I know some people have second round grades. I think he might be a guy that you might have is climbing up draft boards. Mason Taylor, the tight end out of LSU. He's another guy that if you've got a conviction about him as a tight end, that maybe you take a look at him. So those would be the guys, like if you were to trade back down in that 20s area, that I would start looking at as guys that Seattle could target.
You talked about a couple of players there. Two I'd like to get back on. One is a quarterback who isn't really being linked to the Seahawks, but the Seahawks have talked about it, or John Schneider has talked about it. I think it was a couple of years ago when he was I don't know if it was JSN's pro day or something like that. he suddenly name dropped Quinn Ewers. And nobody's talking about, oh, you haven't mentioned Quinn Ewers yet. One. And the other one is, I know someone who likes him a lot, and you haven't mentioned him, but Thomas likes Tyler Booker. He's a really good guard. I loved his, I think it was at the combine where he had the all-time quote of having like, the guys I play against, I don't want them to love football anymore, which I find really great. But I think he doesn't really fit the scheme the Kubiak wants to run, right?
Yeah, so on Tyler Booker, I love Tyler Booker. I think he would come in immediately and be the alpha male or the alpha on Seattle's offensive line. And they don't have one right now, and he would. He'd come in, he'd set that tone. Like on our show previously, I compared him to when Seattle went and got Jaron Reed. Jaron Reed was the alpha on that Alabama defense at that time and when he got drafted, and he brought that presence, and he's kept that presence through his time in Seattle. And Tyler Booker would do the same. My concerns with Tyler Booker do land into what you were talking about, Jonas, is his ability to play in the wide zone scheme. Like, if we were still running power gap, Tyler Booker is the pick. I'm, pounding the table for them to take Tyler Booker. That's not to say I don't think he can translate, but we've seen what's happened with prior linemen that are very physically built for a skill set and a scheme, and they're in that, and that's what they play, struggle to translate. Like, you look at Christian Haynes. When we tried to put him in power gap last year, he couldn't do it. He couldn't anchor. He couldn't do the things he needed to do. But you allow him to play with leverage and use his speed and his angles, and he's great in zone. If you're asking Tyler Booker to do the reverse, that's where I get a little concerned. Can Tyler Booker move laterally quick enough, get to that second level, be able to get hands on linebackers and stuff, which this zone scheme requires? That's where my toss-up is with Booker. I wouldn't hate the pick. I'd be fine with it. But I would assume then that John Benton and Rick Dennison have looked at his tape and gone, you know what? There's enough there that we can coach up quickly enough to get him on the field. Because again, if you're taking Tyler Booker at 18, like I will say this over again, and John said it on a show, you're expecting that guy to start on your team day one. That's where, for me, if I'm taking Tyler Booker, I hope that John Benton and Rick Dennison have enough conviction to go, yeah, we can start him day one. He will pick up the scheme and go with it. On the other note, with Quinn Ewers, you are right. John Schneider did name drop him at JSN's Pro Day and talking about that a few years ago. Quinn Ewers is interesting to me because if you look at Quinn Ewers when he's on the road in his college career, he looks like the top quarterback. Like, it's no comparison. You put him at home and all of a sudden it's like you're looking at a guy and it's like Jekyll and Hyde. Which guy are you going to get? Which game? And I don't like Texas's offense with Sarkisian calling the plays in the scheme because it just, to me, is so gimmicky. It's all these little bubble screens and RPOs and stuff. Now, I will say this. John Schneider is big on connections. And one of John Schneider's big connections is Mike McCarthy. And Mike McCarthy is currently being Quinn Ewers' quarterback coach through the draft process. And I think if Mike McCarthy goes and Quinn Ewers is there in day three, I think there's a chance that, he looks at it and goes, Mike, can this guy do it? Yup. Take a swing on him. And they could take a swing on Quinn Ewers. I think, for me, what I've heard and just talking to different people that are connected, there are guys that Seattle is looking at that, again, they don't bring in for visits or kind of keep their distance from because they don't want people to know that they're actually interested in them. I think Quinn Ewers could be that guy. So we'll have to see, but I like some of his tape. I'm just not sold on Quinn Ewers for that.
Really, really good, good transition there as well. Speaking of picks you're not really that high on, are there picks which are being discussed? Like I read a lot about where a lot of people are pretty skeptical, but Mina Kimes is loving him. Ted McMillan, who is a big X receiver, but we talked about it, the Seahawks are not drafting for need anymore. They do need an X receiver. They do need another receiver in this draft, I think. But do they need one at 18? And which pick would you really, or are there a couple of picks you would really hate going at 18, like quarterbacks?
So if they took Jalen Milroe at 18, I would throw my remote through the TV screen and lose my mind. That I would hate, guys. If they went out and took, it's hard at pick 18. I'm trying to think of guys. If they went out and took a running back, Ashton, like I love Ashton Jeanty, but if you take a running back at 18, I'm going to lose my marbles. And the other thing would be safety for me. As crazy as that sounds, because I know that there's everyone got really enamored with Nick Amon-Ryoh, and there's Malachi Starks, and I like both those guys. But I don't think at 18 a safety makes enough value sense unless you're coming. And Seattle has two good safeties on the roster, and Kobe Bryant, who's one of the guys I've been super high on since they drafted him, and Julian Love. So I don't look at safety as, hey, we need to go spend our top pick on that because, okay, who's he starting over? Is he now starting over Kobe? Is he now starting over Julian Love? Like, that's where, for me, those would be the picks. Again, if they have conviction about Nick Amon-Ryoh or Malachi Starks, I would say that that's like three for me on the scale of hate picks. But one would be like a quarterback like Jalen Milroe or Shedeur Sanders or one of those guys. Even Jackson Dart, I would not be a big fan of at 18. Or a running back.
One quick thing. I think Jalen Milroe was invited to the draft, which is kind of a sign for me, because the NFL in the last couple of years, they deviated from like bringing a lot of guys in, because you have the Will Levis situation where he was sitting there and was, I think, pretty embarrassing for him. But they just bring, I think, 20-25 guys in who they do think will go in round one, because otherwise they wouldn't invite them. But they did invite Jalen Milroe. So does the NFL know something we don't?
That's interesting. With Jalen Milroe getting the invite, I think part of it is like when he was going through the last season, he was a very big college name. And you're trying to bring in guys that are going to strum up exactly what they're doing, which is noise and buzz and all those kind of things. Jalen Milroe being there is good for the NFL marketing-wise, because now you've got someone that everyone's going to talk about. Well, why is Jalen Milroe there? All these drafts analysts are saying that he should be going in the second or third round. Why would he want to sit there? I think there's a chance him or Jackson Dart does go in the late first round. I think people, if they're taking Milroe, are banking on, okay, we're going to develop him and he's going to be Lamar Jackson type 2.0. I think he's more of a Jalen Hurts type quarterback. I could see a team like Pittsburgh taking a swing on one of those two. Like, I expect there to be potentially three quarterbacks that go in the first round. And I think, you know, the third one is going to be Dart or Milroe. And it's going to be either, I could see Dart going to the Rams or Dart going to Pittsburgh. And I could see Milroe going to Pittsburgh. So it'll be interesting. Like, if he doesn't get picked, he's going to be very lonely in that green room sitting there by himself on day two.
I think so too.
Looking forward to the draft, it's always a kind of lottery and you never know what's about to come. Looking to the big board, do you see a big surprise in there? Do you see one or two sleeper maybe also as a fit to the Seahawks? And do you also see maybe that what busts people always talking about? Sanders, is he really number one or number two, number three pick, or maybe is he a downfall to a late round in number one? What's your opinion about that?
Okay. So for guys that I think could be a bust, it's interesting with this draft class because I haven't seen anyone with enough hype to think that they're going to be a superstar. Cam Ward's gotten a little of that. Like, some people think he could be like the next Mahomes type quarterback with what he can do. I don't know if he doesn't turn into that, if he's a bust. I would say the one that, if he turned out to be a bust, that I think would shock everybody is Ashton Jeanty. I think he's one of the best prospects in this draft class. And if he somehow turned into Trent Richardson, when Trent Richardson came from being this huge product in college and then busted in the NFL, that would be really, really surprising to me. And that would be something that I'd go like, wow, that's shocking. The other one I would say is maybe like a Will Campbell, if he goes in the top five and he struggles as a tackle and some team plays him as a tackle, because I personally see him better suited to play guard. if he plays tackle and struggles in the NFL like Luke Jokel did when he was with Seattle and Jacksonville, that's something that I could see as an interesting kind of, you know, situation. For sleepers for Seattle, I've got a couple guys. So Bryce Caleb-Dew out of Kansas is a guy I really like. He's an offensive tackle. I think he'll be a guard, but he's 6'7", and he loves zone blocking. Like, he just, he finishes guys. And so he's a guy I could see. Joshua Gray is a guard out of Oregon State that I think could be a mid-round guy, maybe rounds 5 or 6. He, again, you know, he's played a lot of college football. He has 2,300 college snaps, which is quite a lot for a guard. He's only allowed one sack in 2024. So again, he's good in pass pro. He fits the scheme. He would be developmental. So you'd bring him in and he'd be pushing Anthony Bradford or LaMea for that roster spot for the first year. A one guy I'm sure you guys have heard of, a lot of Seahawks people start talking about, is Chase Lund out of UConn. Comes from the same scheme as, you know, Christian Haynes. So he's another guy. And then my honorable mention for this group that I think is a sleeper that could be late day two, day three, is Jalen Royals, a receiver out of Utah State. 6'195". I think he adds a little bit of a different skill set to the offense than what they currently have. He can take off and he can run. He can be a deep threat, but he kind of has a bit of like a Deebo Samuel feel to him. He can return kicks. So he's a guy I'd be interested in, you know, maybe rounds 2 or round 4, I think, is somewhere he could be. So those are some guys I'd be looking at in kind of the sleeper pick area potentially.
Uh-huh.
Another thing before we go on to the finish straight here, we talked about the Seahawks a lot. Kind of going back a bit, looking at the division and looking at the like first round, are there players when they like would be going to the Rams or to the Niners, you would say, gosh darn it, why? Because like last year we saw Jared Verse going to the Rams and being defensive rookie of the year there.
Yeah.
Are there players you where you'd say, okay, just come on, Cowboys, just pick him, or the Bears pick him so they won't fall to the Niners or the Rams?
Oh man, okay. So for the Niners, I would say probably if like Josh Simmons or a Membu ended up being there, that they have now their heir apparent to Trent Williams at left tackle. Like, I'm okay with them not having someone to succeed Trent Williams. Like, let him get old, let him disappear. I don't need to see the Niners replenish that group. One other guy for them would probably be like a Mike Green or a Devon Ezeraku to go along with Nick Bosa and that D-line front. I don't need them to have any more guys. For the Rams, I do not want Sean McVay to get Jackson Dart.
Yeah.
I think that is a very, very terrible thing for Seattle fans, is to give Sean McVay a quarterback with Dart skill set, his understanding of the game, and his mobility. It's going to cause nightmares for Seattle fans, and I think they don't realize it yet. So that would be, because right now they have Jimmy Garoppolo on their roster. So if Stafford gets hurt, it's like, oh, okay, like Jimmy G, we're fine, we can handle. If all of a sudden it's like, hey, now we're getting this rookie kid that's got a cannon for an arm, and he can move and he can do different things. I don't want to see him there. And for the Cardinals, oh, this is a good one. I don't want to see the Cardinals get Kenneth Grant. I do not want to see them get an interior D lineman that can really wreak havoc and cause problems there. Like, I don't want to see Kenneth Grant in our division unless he's in neon green and blue. That's, you know, that's, and he would probably go in that area where Thomas was asking earlier, guys, I'd love it. Pick 18. Kenneth Grant's another guy that I would throw in that area. So, as long as he's not on any other team in the NFC West, I'll be happy, unless it's a Seattle Seahawks jersey.
Unfortunately, we own a late pick or late fix in round 2, but would it be wise maybe to trade up? We talked before starting the podcast. Would it be wise to trade up in round 2 for some of the guys?
I think that's a real possibility for John Schneider. Like, people have talked about him trading up in round 1. No, that I doubt that. I could see them doing a situation where maybe they even trade back in round 1, get another pick later on, use that pick to take pick 50 and move up into the earlier part of round two. That's something I could see Seattle trying to do. That way they're not really losing out on a pick. They're just repositioning themselves with the same quantity in that top 100, because that is quite a drop from where they are at 18 to pick 50, and there's going to be a lot of good players that go in there. So that I could definitely see that, Thomas, where they move up in round two to try and get close that gap a bit, so they're not missing out on a bunch of players that potentially could go in that window.
Yeah.
Speaking about that trading up in the second round, what would a successful draft for the Seahawks look like? You mentioned it beforehand, like. A lot of people are fixated on the offensive line and say, okay, yeah, you have to the offensive line group is pretty good. There's a lot of value in there, but me personally, I would say, okay, like in the first three picks, taking two offensive linemen would be a waste of draft resources. What would a successful draft look like for you for the Seahawks? What would you like to see?
So the goals for a successful draft is, and I'm going to say this and everyone will love me, fix the line, like address the line and address it with some quality. Don't just be taking late swings on developmental guys, like actually go get some guys that you know can come in and impact the line. Find a playmaker at receiver position. There's some guys, Jaden Higgins, Jalen Royals, Mbuka. Get another playmaker in there, even a tight end like Loveland potentially. Add defensive depth, add to a strength, go and add to your defensive line, add to your linebackers. Like linebacker depth is an issue for the Seahawks, and not a lot of people are talking about it because of the fact that you don't have anybody behind Knight or Tyrese Knight or Ernest Jones. You have Drake Thomas. Like get some depth in there. Maybe quarterback insurance, that's down that list for me. Maybe get a guy. But then also don't do a bunch of reaching in this draft. Don't reach on guys that you think may work out, which has gotten them in trouble in the past. Stick to your best player available. And if the need and that match up, then take that swing on that player. Don't go, oh, we have this huge need over here that we need to go swing on a guy that maybe doesn't have all the characteristics. Those are the kind of things I would say. So like for me, if they got a Gray Zabel, a Donovan Jackson, someone like that in the, you know, a guard with one of their picks. Again, I don't think that's a reality, but that's someone. Getting a corner is a need for me. So like if they got Revell in the second round because he falls because of his medical, there's the guy I would take. Get a tight end, Mason Taylor, Elijah Royu, one of those guys in that area. And then address your offensive line through rounds 4 and 7 too, like a Caleb Dew, Josh Gray. And then again, I think you could take a running back in this class because you got some guys coming up on expiring contracts in K9 and Charbonnet, but don't do that until rounds 5 or 7. You're going to get some value in there. You don't have to spend a upper pick to do that. So those are kind of be the things I would look at. And again, like even in the first round, like an Ezeraku or Kenneth Grant, taking one of those guys and then addressing O-line in the second round with a Donovan Jackson or something like that, or Tate Ratledge. That's still a fine plan. I don't think, you know, it'll be interesting to see, obviously, Seahawk Twitter and Discords and all that. Seattle definitely taking a lineman at pick 18 or in that first round. How many people freak out, even though they get, say, a Kenneth Grant or an Ezeraku or one of these guys that could be a blue chip player for them and a real contributor, them freak out because, well, they're on defense. And it's the O-line and everyone's so hyper-fixated. But then in round two, they come back and they get a Donovan Jackson or a Tate Ratledge. And then they add a, you know, Caleb Dew or one of these guys in the third round or something. And it's like, okay, well, you've now taken two picks and put them to the O-line and you still have guys on this roster. And that's what everyone is so quick to write off, Christian Haynes and Olu Atimi and Jalen Sundell and these other guys they brought in. There's a reason those guys were brought in. They do have good talent. Christian Haynes was the number one ranked guard last year in the draft. And we were all excited when we got him. And because he had a bad rookie year where he didn't really even get to play, everyone's already contributed that he's a trash pick or he's a bust or whatever you want to call it. Let's see what this new staff with an actual proper NFL background can actually do with these players.
Awesome. We did cover a lot of things. There's still a lot of things to cover with the draft coming up. But yeah, I think we're all really, really excited about it because yeah, the Seahawks really have I love the signing of Mike McDonald, and I think the Seahawks have a really bright future. So, Bryce, thank you very much for coming on. I think it won't be the last time you're on here. Without further ado, it's a bit late here coming up to like 11 o'clock. So, thank you very much. Have a great weekend, and we're really looking forward to the draft. And I think we're gonna end here with the our common Go Hawks.
Thanks for having me, guys. Greatly appreciate it. I'll come back anytime. So it was a lot of fun, and I enjoy talking Hawks with you guys.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Touchdown, Seahawks!
Weitere Infos zu den German Seahawkers gibt's natürlich auch auf unserer Website unter germanseahawkers.com.